Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. It is, well, it's turned out to be controversial. Shouldn't be, especially for Christians, not in the least. The Nashville Statement simply is a statement narrowly focused on a subject, that is the LGBTQ agenda, which is complicated, but it is pretty simple to understand in terms of sin and what the Bible teaches about homosexuality and other deviant forms of sexuality. So there's nothing controversial there. It's simply a statement of what the church has confessed and believes about that. It doesn't pretend to speak to even broader issues, and it doesn't pretend to speak to a broader audience. That's the big question here. What is the audience of this Nashville statement from a group that, well, their very name raises controversy, because in today's culture, to talk about manhood and womanhood is, well, it's an affront to any decent thinking person, isn't it? The Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood in August issued the Nashville statement. Many have signed on online. How is it being covered in the media, and who was it intended for? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about growing LGBT theological tensions among American evangelicals, as both signaled by and triggered by the Nashville statement, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
Ordinarily, a statement like this would probably just be kind of water cooler conversation at your average evangelical mainstream Protestant church. But this one is getting national attention. Why the notoriety?
Well, I've got a theory about this that might be slightly convoluted, but let me go into it. I think the first thing to understand is that once again, we're in the age of Trump. And you saw in the Washington Post story on this piece, the original one, a very major theme in it was five signers of this document are on President Trump's Evangelical Advisory Committee. Now, the implication there is this must be another part of the entire Trump revolution. Well, the biggest news in this thing, in many ways, was the fact that while there were a couple of Trump advisor people who signed it, there were many, many more people who signed this who have not only been critical of Trump, they have outright opposed him, you know, at every stage of the game. So to some degree, this was like a statement coming out that was endorsed, you know, by competing wings of the current conservative political establishment. Once again, if you concede that Trump is some kind of systematic conservative as opposed to kind of his own celebrity brand of populism. So once again, you had some Trump here. The second thing you had, this statement was written by evangelicals to evangelicals. And in a way, that's the best thing about it, and it's also the worst thing about it. I'll come back to that later. The really interesting point, though, is that we have in this day and age genuine media-friendly liberal evangelicals, doctrinally liberal evangelicals, some of them who will not really like state their convictions openly, but it's very clear from their statements that they believe that the church has been wrong on the issue of gender and sexuality for 2,000 years. You will very rarely hear them state it that way. You'll hear them stated instead that this evangelical statement is cruel and unnecessary, or you'll hear them say it's time to rethink things, et cetera, et cetera. But every now and then you get a statement of clarity on this issue. And the press in the number of years now has specifically tried to find evangelical voices to feature and to quote. And to no one's surprise, many of the evangelicals that they have embraced or ordained as the new spokespeople for this era happen to be kind of left of the center evangelicals. And I think the key moment in this, and it's why I led my column this week with this very articulate and clear quote from a professor who teaches now at Mercer University in Georgia, which for years was thought of primarily as a Southern Baptist school. Mercer is now kind of like the Southern hub for the alternative Baptists who lost in the Southern Baptist Civil War of the late 70s and early 80s. And it has a host of other liberal, progressive connections within the world of kind of low church Protestant evangelicals. One of the, probably the most famous professor there is a man named David Gushee. And until a couple of years ago, or maybe it's been 7 or 8 years ago, he was best known for teaching at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, Union being a very conservative Southern Baptist school. And then Gushee moved from Union to Mercer, a very symbolic move in the Baptist world. Well, he writes a column as an evangelical spokesperson. He writes a column for Religion News Service. And last year, he wrote a column that included some very interesting quotes. I've edited this a little, but I haven't changed any meaning here. It turns out that you are either for full and unequivocal social and legal equality for LGBT people, or you are against it, wrote Gushee. Now, here's where he gets really, really blunt. Neutrality is not an option. Neither is polite half-acceptance, nor is avoiding the subject. Hide as you might, this issue will come and find you. Now, in evangelicalism, a lot of people read that as a threat, and it basically said, we're coming after you one way or another, or probably more like what he meant is, the culture is coming after you. There's going to be no way to hide and oppose full equality for LGBT people. And that would certainly include those who just simply argue that centuries of tradition in the Christian church deserve some sort of respect and ability to defend itself in terms of discrimination in schools or religious organizations where people are hired on the basis of doctrine. So anyway, Gushee put the statement out. I don't have any doubts at all that his statement, along with many other things, you remember, gosh, how long ago was it? A couple of years ago that we had the massive blow up at InterVarsity, where InterVarsity gently tried to parse the homosexual issue so that its outlets in, no, it wasn't InterVarsity. InterVarsity's had its own struggles on this. It was an aid agency. Help me out here. What was the name of the group a couple of years ago? Major evangelical group in social work and ministry in terms of bringing aid to the poor.
Well, the only one I can think of right off the top of my head is
Samaritan's Purse, but that's probably not the one you're thinking of.
No, that's not it. And that, so I'm having a senior moment here, people. But suffice it to say, it's one of the most powerful evangelical organizations there is. And they found out within a matter of days that there was no way they could parse this thing in the middle. And they had to kind of swing back to orthodoxy because of the number of, you know, canceled gifts they had, the number of people threatening to cancel gifts, etc. So either if you look at it from the left or the right, it's becoming increasingly apparent that there is no neutrality on this issue if you define it in doctrinal terms. So I guess that's the big story here. The evangelical world, at least in certain sectors of that world, is now officially divided on homosexuality. Now, there may be some that are openly pro-gay rights. Probably you have more people that would fall into the category that I would call anti-gay rights. In other words, they're not pro-gay rights, but they oppose just about any statement that anybody makes in an attempt to defend traditional church teachings. So they want compassion and mercy and silence, primarily. They talk about building bridges and compassion and whatever else. And you hear that kind of language in some of the voices on the evangelical left. Most of them are writers, or they're in academia. Jen Hatmaker responded to the Nashville statement on Twitter with a blunt statement: "The fruit of the Nashville statement is suffering, rejection, shame, and despair." Then you have a very powerful figure in the world of evangelicalism as a journalist, another columnist for RNS, but he also writes for The Atlantic and elsewhere, Jonathan Merritt, who is the son, interestingly enough, of a former Southern Baptist president who signed the statement. And this is a man whose position on sexuality is quite complex in terms of his own private life, but I believe it's totally accurate to call him at this point an LGBT activist. He bluntly said, "A statement like this is unlikely to move the needle with those who aren't already in agreement. It's all head and no heart. It's all words and no word made flesh." Suffice it to say, this, as I said, this was an evangelical statement to evangelicals. The fact that it's blown up into such a huge national issue, I think, is primarily because there are such now bitter divisions emerging within what we used to think of as even the evangelical world. If you didn't think there was an evangelical left, you should now know without any doubt whatsoever that there is an evangelical left, which is why this group of conservative evangelicals, conservative doctrinally, decided that they needed to make a statement to evangelicals saying, come on, stand firm, don't compromise.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about growing LGBT theological tensions among American evangelicals on this Thursday, September the 7th, when we come back. The audience is key. I wonder, is the audience also addressed to people in the church who are waving or who are quietists?
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, Ad Crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADC, RUCEM.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I believe in God the Father Almighty. Millions confess the great creeds of the church each week. But why? Learn more about Christian creeds and Lutheran confessions this month in The Lutheran Witness. Get 6 issues of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's premier magazine for only $6.99 when you visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/try-Lutheran-witness.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about growing LGBT theological tensions among American evangelicals. Before the break, Terry, you were talking about the intended audience of the Nashville statement, and that the intended audience is really the people who are kind of, I don't know, we'd say today wavering. Also, I wonder whether or not the intended audience are those who are leaning toward being quiet at this time, just not to rock the boat when it comes to LGBT issues. What do you think?
Yep. Once again, though, remember that from the viewpoint of the secular press, almost everything must in some way be stated as politics. So the fact that this is an openly theological statement, I mean, in almost every single word of it, and it's saying that there are a lot of pressures on the church today. It's acknowledging that those pressures are real. When you read it, I hear a little bit of Benedict Option realism in here. I mean, nobody's trying to hide the changing times. In fact, when you look at the very top of the document, it states right up front that we, as Western culture, has become increasingly post-Christian. It has embarked upon a massive revision of what it means to be a human being. Now, if you want to talk about what's interesting in this statement and what isn't, and what, like, say, I might have wanted to see them do differently, it is, for better or for worse, it is an evangelical language statement to other evangelicals. Would this document have been different if it had been run through, just say, as editors or co-writers, a collection of Roman Catholic conservatives, Eastern Orthodox conservatives, and even, I dare say, people in both of those folds who see themselves as gay or lesbian, yet who support the church's teachings? And there are some interesting and fascinating voices in that camp. Would the wording of this document have been different in ways that would have made it a little harder to have attacked for its bluntness? I think the answer to that is yes, but in a way, the attacks were going to come no matter what, because this is, simply stated, a statement of heresy in our current culture. I think the eye-opening experience for a lot of people is to realize the degree to which this statement is a statement of heresy within the world of evangelicalism, especially at the level of publishing, academia, and kind of think tanks.
An attempt at some correction was made in the last couple of days by Albert Mohler, who is, by the way, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. He wrote for the Washington Post, and I think the headline of his, I don't know if he penned the headline, but it certainly encapsulates his column, saying, "I signed the Nashville Statement. It's an expression of love for same-sex attracted people." Who is he talking to then? Both audiences?
Well, to some degree, I mean, he's an important enough voice that you could see that getting some media attention. But good grief, the media has been ignoring his opposition to Trump long enough. I mean, and he's about as mainstream a Southern Baptist voice as there is to pit against some of the other well-known Baptists who went with Trump. So Mohler, you know, I that could conceivably get some attention, but once again, he's talking to evangelicals. And also, never forget the degree to which he represents one of the formation areas for this emerging world of Southern Baptist clergy and thinkers who are aggressively Calvinist in their thinking. They're quite intellectual, and they're growing. I mean, that's a growing power inside modern evangelical world, especially within the Southern Baptist Convention. So I think to some degree he has the ability to talk to a lot of young leaders within the SBC that others might not. So that's just, that's my take on that.
You also, when you wrote about this recently, dealt with some statements from Union Professor Hunter Baker, mm-hmm. Union University. What did he have to say?
Well, the primary thing he said is that this is a statement to other evangelicals. He also stressed, even within the world of evangelicalism, he stressed the importance of the world of academia, young Christian intellectuals, and also publishing, Christian publishing. And by that I mean the major publishing houses as well as possibly periodicals. I haven't parsed who has signed it up to this point. It would be interesting to see if anyone in the wider world of Christianity today has endorsed the Nashville Statement, as opposed to one of the initial signers, another Calvinist, Marvin Alasky. So you look for all the symbols of who's backing this or not. Is there anyone from the wider world of Tim Keller and Redeemer Presbyterian in this mix? Or are those people who would have signed if the wording had just been a little bit more ecumenical, a little bit more nuanced, the kinds of wording that you might get, once again, with a Catholic or two involved, in the process? If Robbie George of Princeton had been involved in this, would it have sounded differently? I think you could have expected a few carefully chosen words that would be different. But is there anybody to the doctrinal right of Robbie George right now on moral and social issues? I would say no. It's been very interesting to watch the dialogue about this at Rod Dreher's website, in terms of the different types of conservatives, most of whom have criticized the statement for being too narrow. Rod himself has said that he wishes that there were much stronger statements in it on things like pornography and the whole world of no-fault divorce. I mean, Rod's, I think, absolutely right when he says whatever damage gay rights has done to marriage, you have to primarily say that straight people and silence from the church has done way more damage to marriage in the last couple of decades than anything that's been done by the gay rights movement. So maybe someone like Rod would have wanted to have seen that stated in some way that was more open. Take kind of the straight world taking more blame, for its own conditions.
We're talking with Terry Mattingly about growing LGBT theological tensions among American evangelicals. He's senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. When we come back, we recently talked with him about Eugene Peterson, who had for a moment wavered on the issue of same-sex marriage and homosexual relationships and then was very quickly set back in line. Does he stand in for that wavering evangelical? We'll answer that question right after this.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Daily worship, historical hymnody, and catechesis interwoven with direct instruction in phonics, traditional math, literature, grammar, history, Latin, and strings. It's part of our daily life at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, the only classical Lutheran school in Greater St. Louis. We're located 1 mile off Interstate 55. For more information, visit school.stpaulhamel.org. We would love to share our joy in learning with your child. school.stpaulhamel.org.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, September the 7th. We're talking with Terry Mattingly of Get Religion about the growing LGBT theological tensions among American evangelicals and the Nashville Statement. A little bit later, Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. We're going to be doing our series, Christ in the Old Testament. We'll be in Psalm 32, Blessed Are the Forgiven. Terry, I'm wondering if there's more context here. We recently talked, if I'm recalling correctly, about Eugene Peterson, popular Christian author, who in an interview, I believe, with Jonathan Merritt, had wavered on the issue of gay marriage and homosexuality in a pretty obvious way. I wonder if he stands in for that wavering evangelical who is the audience of the Nashville Statement.
Well, you certainly saw how quickly the evangelical world responded to those statements, once again running through the lens and the framework of Jonathan Merritt and his connection to the mainstream press. If these issues continue to be framed by the evangelical left over and over and over, these controversies will continue to blow sky high. But stop and think about this. Name the conservative evangelicals who have access to the mainstream press to the same degree that some of these writers do. By the way, with a few tip-taps in the background on my keyboard, my brain freeze has been cured. I was referring to the controversy a couple of years ago at World Vision, and that was focusing on certain legal challenges and cultural challenges in Canada, you know, as opposed to what was happening into America. And World Vision's had to back down very sharply. I think to some degree, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, where I must stress I was a faculty member in one capacity or another for 20-something years, you would have to say that the council's has been pulled back and forth both ways on this issue and has really tried to find some sort of neutral ground in the middle or some sort of ground that would please people on both sides. And the simple fact of the matter is that that doctrinal ground does not exist. I've been saying now for several decades that I think you could sell pay-per-view world wrestling style tickets to the day that the Wheaton College Board of Trustees meets to debate this issue. The evangelical academic world is incredibly divided. I would point out that Union, where Gushy taught for a long time, and where you have many people connected to the Nashville Statement who teach there now, the man I quoted, Hunter Baker, would certainly just be one example out of many. Union even backed away from the CCCU over the clarity of the CCCU's position on this issue. Union now has a website being fostered upon it. You know, when you look at it, a group of Union alumni have now started a website to chastise their own alma mater, and especially their president, Samuel Dub Oliver. And I would notice that Oliver used to be a high official at Baylor University, my own alma mater, and a school that certainly will be debating this over and over in the years ahead, if only because of the pressure on its athletic programs from television and other forms of secular power. The statement from students to the president of Union right now was very blunt. They called his signature on the Nashville Statement a declaration of bigotry and condemnation that is a far cry from the hope, faith, hope, love, and acceptance we were taught was the hallmark of the faith of Union University. Once again, the word, anytime the word bigotry comes involved, you're getting a direct theological comparison to discussions over race, for example. Several people have said that the timing of the Nashville statement was particularly painful. And when you read that kind of language, they're saying that this statement is connected to Charlottesville and to the alt-right, which I think is an absolutely fascinating statement to make about a statement in which there is hardly anything in this document that would be rejected by someone like Pope Francis if you choose the Catholic wordings for these doctrines instead of evangelical wordings. I've seen several pieces by traditional Catholics who say, yeah, there are things in this we would wish they had said a different way, but on the substance of these doctrines, do we disagree? And they say, no, not at all.
Have we seen a demonstration, I think this is something you hinted at earlier in our conversation, that a real quick way to get into a mainstream journalist's Rolodex or his speed dial is to be an evangelical voice that has made the move toward supporting LGBT activism, as in Jen Hatmaker, as in Jonathan Mara?
Well, I think that that's an obvious point. At the same time, you know, for years people have talked about the New York Times op-ed page. How many conservatives are on the New York Times op-ed page? And you can name several names from the last couple of decades. But then when you say how many of those conservatives are consistent cultural conservatives on issues of, say, abortion and defense of Judeo-Christian teachings on gender and sexuality, at that point, zoom, the list goes all the way down to one. You've even heard the phrase applied to David Brooks that he is the, I think this is an unfair statement for him, by the way. You've heard people say he is the New York Times' version of a conservative. Just like in Republican arguments, it comes down to the big tent, and the libertarian world is not the same thing at all as the social conservative world. Now, I don't think you can pin the word libertarian on a lot of the evangelical left, because many of them, frankly, tend to be economic progressives. But I do think we have reached the point where in the world of evangelicalism, you have to simply say, do you or do you not embrace 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian teachings, or Christian teachings for sure, on issues of marriage and sexuality? You've heard me talk for a long time about the TMAT trio, the three doctrines in the TMAT trio, which have been, I started using those as a reporter in Denver, Colorado in the 1980s. Do you by any chance, let's call this a test, do you happen to remember the TMAT trio?
I'm sure that my memory could be jarred, but off the top of my head, no. What is it?
Okay, number one, the resurrection of Jesus Christ happened in real time in the real world. Number two is salvation is through Jesus Christ alone. You can choose the word faith or grace. I choose to leave that out and make it direct. Salvation is in the name of Jesus Christ alone. Number two. And number three, sex outside of marriage is a sin. Now stop and think about that. You immediately get into the definition of marriage, but is there any question on the definition of marriage in terms of 2,000 years of Catholic catechism and Orthodox Christian teaching? No, I cite those because those churches have been in existence for 2,000 years, as opposed to the world of Protestantism. We can get back to Luther another day. Luther and other newcomers, I'll provoke the audience a bit there. But the simple statement, sex outside of marriage is a sin. Now, once again, the minute you use the word sin, you're using doctrinal language. You're not talking about politics, are you? you're talking about what someone believes in terms of a statement of religious doctrine. But do we live in an age where you could walk into almost any mainline Protestant group in America and say, sex outside of marriage is a sin, raise your hands? Would there be division? Of course. How about cultural Catholicism as a whole? Division? Of course. Dare I ask, maybe if everybody had blinders on or you turned off the lights and asked them just to click a flashlight, a group of Missouri Synod Lutherans, sex outside of marriage is sin. Maybe there wouldn't be much division, but do you think there'd be some? Yeah. College faculties for Christian colleges and universities from coast to coast, sex outside of marriage is a sin? Yes. Major division. You're going to have division and debate. And above all, you're going to have a lot of people say, well, why do you need to even ask that question? Can't we just get back to loving Jesus? And that's the wording we're going to be hearing for quite some time now.
Finally, then, if you were called by a New York Times reporter as kind of a little research, a little background, and they said, look, can you just explain to me in kind of normal reporter, secular reporter's terms, what the Nashville Statement is about and what I need to know about it, how would you answer that question?
I would, because I'm thinking like a reporter and thinking of what the next story is, I would immediately say, sit down with a liberal Catholic, a conservative Catholic, and some of the writers of this document, and I would look point by point and compare this statement with the language that's in the Roman Catholic Catechism as framed and shaped by the thinking of Saint John Paul II and Pope Benedict. And even the what we think of as liberal statements, but the statements on marriage, gender, big word there for him, Pope Francis, gender and sexuality, I would compare the Nashville Statement with what the Roman Catholic Church has stated and then stand back and say, is this statement really as wild as some people think it is? I think a lot of reporters, if they did that work with liberals and Catholics together discussing it, liberals and conservatives discussing it, I think they would be very shocked at just the intellectual content that they would be exposed to. Would they be open to hearing it? That's a whole other issue.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
On the other side of the break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Our series with him every week is called Christ in the Old Testament. We'll be in Psalm 32, Blessed Are the Forgiven, on this Thursday afternoon. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about Christ there in the Psalms and, in particular, Psalm 32.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel, from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A year ago, my wife and I returned to America from 5 years of ministry in Karachi, Pakistan. I cannot adequately express how wonderful it was listening to Lutheran Public Radio's music broadcast each Sunday morning before church service. We still listen.
You can listen to Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, anytime, day or night, at LutheranPublicRadio.org, Amazon Echo, Google Home, and on the LPR mobile app.
Ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Synod and wondered why more people from your congregation aren't there? Then check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so your circuit can prepare, promote, and present a seminar that will appeal to all the members of your congregation, provided for free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org, theclcc.org, and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.